Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Author, activist, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel has lived through and thought through some of the darkest moments in human history. His memoir, Night, introduced millions to the Holocaust. His lifetime of work has explored and lit up the deep moral and human implications of that vast tragedy. Now at 80, he's out with a new novel of the Holocaust's aftermath, A Mad Desire to Dance. This hour, On Point, a conversation with Elie Wiesel. You can join us. Has Elie Wiesel been your guide through the moral implications, the nightmare of the Holocaust? And what's your question for him today? Joining me now from St. Petersburg, Florida, is Elie Wiesel. In 1944, at the age of 15, he was sent with his family to the Auschwitz concentration camp, later in Buchenwald. His first crushing, harrowing account of his time in the camps was published as the memoir, Night. He's written dozens of works since then. He's spoken out recently on the Bernie Madoff scandal, which cost him and many others dearly. Wiesel is professor of humanities at Boston University, winner in 1986 of the Nobel Peace Prize. He's one of our era's greatest thinkers on modern morality and its failings. His new novel is A Mad Desire to Dance. Elie Wiesel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're 80 years old now. You lived this from the time you were 15. You've written about it for more than half a century. What's left to say?
Maybe not enough. In the beginning, I thought I would write only one memoir, and that would be it. Since then, I have written almost 50 books,
right.
And it's not it.
The dance is at the heart of this, and the aftermath, and the desire, the need to live through the madness that anyone would feel after such an experience of the Holocaust. What drew you to that angle?
But believe me, the title is not autobiographical. I have never danced in my life, except with the sacred scrolls in the synagogue. I don't know how to dance. But in this case, dancing expresses something else. That means after the story is done, what my character, my main character in the novel actually says, all of a sudden he realizes that it's never the end. That as long as one lives, every moment contains a spark of eternity.
I wish you'd read from us a little bit from very early in the book, just in the opening passage there, where your main character talks to us about, his subject.
Madness is what I'll talk to you about. Madness burdened with memories and with eyes like everyone else's, though in my story the eyes are like those of a smiling child, trembling with fear. You will ask, is a madman who knows he is mad really mad? Or, in a mad world, isn't the madman who is aware of his madness the only sane person? But let's not rush ahead. If you had to describe a madman, how would you portray him? As a marble-faced stranger, smiling but without joy, his nerves on edge. When he goes into a trance, his limbs move about and all his thoughts collide. Time and again, he has electrical discharges, not in his brain, but in his soul. Do you like the portrait? Let's continue. How can we talk about madness except by using the specific language of those who carry it within themselves? What if I told you that within each of us, whether in good health or bad, there is a hidden zone, a secret region that opens out into madness? One misstep, one unfortunate blow of fate is enough to make us slip or flounder with no hope or ever rising up again. Careless mistakes, an impaired memory of errors of judgment, can provoke a series of falls. it then becomes impossible to make ourselves understood by those we call, rather foolishly, kindred souls. If you will not grant me this, I will have a serious problem. But you must not feel sorry for me. Tears sometimes leave furrows, but never very deep ones, in any case, not deep enough. There, this is what you have to know, for a start.
Elie Wiesel, Nobel Peace Prize winner, reading from his new book, A Mad Desire to Dance, in the voice there of his narrator. We'll learn more about that story. Elie Wiesel, I wonder, I've listened to you so often, and I wondered if you could describe the arc of how your understanding of your experience of the Holocaust has changed over these years, from the time when you were a teenager and exiting that hell, to the time that you began writing and speaking about it, to now all these years later. What does that arc in its simplest form look like, of your own understanding of that experience?
It hasn't really changed. If I had to write this memoir, I think I would write it the same way, with the same comma between two words, trying to introduce the same kind of silence into every page. All that I remember is still fresh in my memory. Lately, I checked it with my friends, with those who together with me were in those places. Some of them are still alive. Lately, we have dreams, and that period is coming back into our dreams much more than before. And the dreams then are dreams, but when we awake, we realize that they were only dreams, but not only dreams, because they still carry within them a trace, a burning scar. Thanks to the scar and the trace, it has left us.
Your protagonist in A Mad Desire to Dance, Doriel Waldman, is in his early 60s, living in New York. He survived the Holocaust. And he talks a lot with his psychotherapist, who's his main sort of dance partner, I guess, in this book, about his feeling of guilt and how it's plagued him all of his life. Has that, you say it's not autobiographical, but has that been your experience, guilt at surviving? Has it been the experience of many, most of those survivors you talk with?
Oh, no. I know that some psychologists, psychotherapists have written about it, and some of them are prestigious people, or were, and they wrote about the survivor's guilt. I don't believe in it. Why should a survivor feel guilty? The perpetrator should feel guilty, not a survivor. The victim should never feel guilty for being a victim or for having been a victim. Have we done anything to survive? I know I have not. Believe me, I have not. I was too timid, too cowardly almost. I was afraid of being beaten, so I have not done anything to survive. I could say today, look, I know very well. I could use words, maybe eloquent or grandiloquent words, and say I wanted to survive to bear witness. No, I didn't want to survive. I had absolutely no desire to survive. As long as my father was alive, I did want to survive, because I knew that if I die, he would die. But then he died.
That is, in the camp, at Auschwitz, Buchenwald.
That was in Buchenwald. Mm-hmm. And then he died. And when he died, something in me died. Therefore, in the book itself, the period between the 28th of January, the day my father died, and April 11, the day we were liberated by the American army, very few pages, because really, I wasn't alive, really. I let myself live. And therefore, there are very few incidents or episodes that I include in the story. So I survived by sheer accident. I could say by miracle, no. I don't like to use this word, because in that case I would ask God, Mr. God, if you saved me, you could have saved a few others better than me, worthier than I. Why didn't you? So no. Again, that I don't believe in the survivor's guilt. No, they should not feel guilty. They have enough problems, coping with their memories, and they, I believe, deserve it to be spared that kind of guilt.
Your protagonist in the new book, Doriel Walden, tells his psychotherapist, "I felt oddly guilty for not feeling guilty enough."
Yes, but that is the protagonist speaking, otherwise he wouldn't go to a psychotherapist. I needed to put him there.
Yes.
The story, after all, is about a psychotherapist. And by the way, Therese is not his dancing partner. At the end, his dancing partner is a beautiful girl who he falls in love with. What is his guilt? Guilty for not knowing why he was there. And then, of course, it was a matter he had to remember, and that memory itself remembers something with his mother and maybe her lover. So that's much more complex than that of a simple survivor's guilt.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nobel Peace Prize winner, activist, author, Holocaust survivor, Elie Wiesel. 50 books into a career, his latest is A Mad Desire to Dance. His memoir, Night, introduced many people around the world to the reality of the Holocaust, came out years ago and has kept coming out. Elie Wiesel, you've talked so much about this. What do you imagine picking up A Mad Desire to Dance? What do you hope they'll take from it? Is this for a new generation of readers? What do you want them to understand?
Well, what is really, I think, the goal, the mission, so to speak, of a teacher or a writer, and I am both. The teacher in me is a writer, and the writer in me is a teacher. It is simply to sensitize the reader, to make him or her aware of the other, of the existence of the other, of the perils of the other, of the problems of the other, of the challenges of the other. I define my humanity by my attitude towards the other. And here again, therefore, in this novel, as in most of my books, I speak about the otherness in the other. I must respect the otherness. I don't want to change the other and make him or her become me. No, I want the other person to be true to himself or herself, and I am there to be his or her companion, at least.
What do you hear back from the younger generation that you still teach at Boston University? When you put your perspective out, when you recall the events that you went through,
I must confess to you, Tom, I rarely teach my own books in my class. I rarely speak about myself. I speak about the suffering of other people, not of mine. For me, Romeo and Juliet, for me, Socrates' last hours are vivid, and I try to bring my students close to them, not to me. But nevertheless, of course, somehow in the background, they all remember having read Night. Most of them have. Having read Night, they remember my memory. And I can tell you that my students at Boston University are among the best I can imagine in the academic community in America. They are so good, so sensitive, and so compassionate. I'll give you an example. Okay, from time to time I get students from Germany who come either to do their PhD and finish it or learn in my class. The way they are being embraced by the entire group around the table is so heartwarming. So as not to make the German student feel excluded or rejected. Oh no, on the contrary, they embrace them. They embrace that student, and that student feels at home. That gives me, of course, much hope and pride.
You have probably seen, along with the rest of us, the news today out of Germany of a shooting in a school there by a recent high school graduate. 15 or so dead. This is near Stuttgart.
I saw it in the press, of course. It happened in us, in our country, in America, mm-hmm. already a few times. And it's contagious. Why should a person kill children? My God, children, young people, for what? There is no reason in the world. Is it simply, I don't know, is it craziness? Is it mad, criminal madness? The madmen in my book are are mystically mad, but not even clinically mad, but mystically, but surely not mad to kill. They may be mad to suffer, but not mad to kill. I believe really that in Germany, they should now investigate not only about the killer, the motives, and see what are the conditions that produce such a young man to come and kill people who he may even haven't known. It's a very serious matter. Whenever a child dies, any child in the world, I believe, I should not look into his or her pocket for an ID. The child is a child is a child and deserves my compassion and my help. So therefore, the children in Germany who were killed, they deserve at least my attention and my concern.
You began as a teenager kind of at the bottom of the moral reality in the middle of the Holocaust. After all these years, do you believe in moral progress?
I do. I forced myself to believe in it. Otherwise, why am I teaching? Why am I writing? I believe the ethos is as important as the logos, meaning what kind of society would I live in if that society were not challenged by ethical issues. Whether, as you quoted, the Rwanda or Darfur, we are challenged. And as long as the challenges are conscious, they demand a reaction.
Elie Wiesel's new book is A Mad Desire to Dance. Mr. Wiesel, we've got a lot of people who want to speak with you. Rosa in Brockton, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Elie Wiesel.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you for the moment.
I just wanted to ask Mr. Wiesel, I read his book while I was on a plane in less than 30 minutes the night, and I wanted to ask him, I know he says that he doesn't have any guilt, but I wanted to ask him, in the book where his father, when his father was dying, if he could go back and change that when his father was calling out to him his last few days before he died, would he go to his father, knowing that that was his father's last wish?
But remember that the conditions, I wasn't alone. Had I left my place and gone to my father, I would have been killed. I would have been beaten up and killed. I'm sure that was not my father's wish. And nevertheless, my father knew how close I was. I kept him with me all the time, wherever I went, until then. But then at that moment, of course, to this day, for instance, I feel sad, terribly sad, for not having had the courage to go. But to say guilt, I'm not sure my father would want me to feel guilty.
Rosa, thanks for your call. Lee in Edisto, South Carolina. You're on the air with Elie Wiesel.
Hi, Tom. My thoughts are that the imperative to be a victim are similar to the imperative of one to kill. As a grandson of a survivor, I've never understood religion. I question it because how could God's will allow this suffering? And then I came to the conclusion that the world's overpopulated, people are starving, people are in dire need, and out of that need may come an imperative to survive. And the ability of a person as a victim to survive may be very similar to the same imperative of a person to kill that victim. And unfortunately, I hate to say, I think it's a genetic imperative. I think it's our need to procreate and to maintain our ability to live in the world. And part of that appears to be this inhumanity. I wish more people were humane and understood the suffering that they cause. But
are you saying it's in the genes we have to be victims and perpetrators? Just as basic as that?
Some of us are basically programmed for it. I don't think that I see this in people. I see a meanness. I see a hardness that shouldn't normally be there. They live in good times. They live well, and yet there's a streak of what you want to call it evil. Call it evil.
Elie Wiesel, how do you respond?
Look, all children or grandchildren of survivors are dear to me, and therefore I respect and empathize with what this young man said. But I don't agree, you know. It would be too easy to say some are born to be victims and others to be killers. No, no. After all, we do have a choice. No matter what, at one moment, at a turning moment in our life, there is a choice that we make. Does it mean that I choose to be a victim? No. And there is no imperative for me to be a victim. I'm not for victimhood. I simply believe we should all have the same right to be human that anyone else. And to say, therefore, that no, I chose my victimhood, nonsense, I did not. Victims are victims because other people made them victims.
Lee, thank you for your call. Let's get one from John in Wareham, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air with Elie Wiesel.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Professor Wiesel, we very much appreciate you. You are one of the moral leaders of the world, and we very much appreciate that. My question is, are you outraged about the progressive destruction of a whole people's economy, the taking of their land and their dignity, their suppression by state violence and their suffering? Should we not all be outraged about what Israel, abetted by the U.S., has been doing to the Palestinians, now living in what President Carter calls the system of apartheid, and what Rashid Khalili calls the iron cage?
Elie Wiesel?
Look, I think President Carter is exaggerating. I think he's wrong on that issue. The plight of the Palestinians is a plight that I cannot ignore, and I shouldn't ignore, and I don't want to ignore. But to enclose all that into what you said, a picture of the situation is, I'm afraid, wrong. Look, historically, the situation began in 1947 when the United Nations voted a partition plan. Israel accepted that plan. Had the Arabs, at that time they didn't even call it a Palestinian state. They wanted a Jewish state and an Arab state, because there was no Palestinian state in history ever. Nevertheless, Israel accepted it. Had the Arabs accepted it, Jaffa, which now is part of Tel Aviv, would not have been Israeli. The airport Lida would not have been Israeli. But they didn't, and they waged war. And since then, there were so many wars waged on Israel. Look, do I agree? Do I accept everything Israel does? No, of course not. Had I been there, had I lived in Israel, believe me, I would have spoken up day after day as a journalist. I would have taken up a column in a paper. But remember, why did Israel go into Gaza? Because thousands and thousands of rockets fell on small Israeli cities. And how can any sovereign state accept that for its citizens? I'll give you an example. The foundation which my wife Marion and I created, we have two centers for the Ethiopian children. One is in Ashkelon and the other one is in Kiryat Malachi. Do you know what we teach now the children? How to find shelter in 20 seconds. To leave the classroom and find shelter in 20 seconds. To avoid being killed by the rockets. And therefore it's really, let's not simplify the situation. The situation is complex enough. Nevertheless, I can tell you, I am the one who brought together for the first time Prime Minister Olmert and the President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, because I believe in a two-state solution, and I believe the Palestinians should have a state. And if I could give them an advice, I would tell them right now, do it now. But we should be careful with our condemnation.
Elie Wiesel is with us. His new book is A Mad Desire to Dance. Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one of a lot of suffering, a lot of complexity. Let me ask you about another. After these years, what's your moral assessment of the U.S. invasion of Iraq? Iraqi rockets were not falling on the United States.
Tom, I'll tell you. Two weeks before the war began, I was invited by the National Security Advisor, Connie, to come to the White House and speak about it. And the president immediately came in and they asked me what to do. And I said to the president, Mr. President, I cannot hear myself say that I am for war, because I know what war is. It means suffering. It means bloodshed. It means destruction. It's ugly. I cannot accept if it's a just war. And the only just war I can speak about was the war against Hitler. So what should we do, he said. I said, look, Mr. President, you said that we must do something to destroy the weapons of mass destruction. There I agree. But that I would call intervention, not war. He said, what's the difference? And I said, war is a political option. Intervention is a moral option. And I even gave them an advice. They were all thinking with amusement and amazement, but that I dared to give an advice. I said, why not send in commandos, the best American commandos, the best British commandos, the best Israeli commandos in American uniform, go into Iraq, destroy the weapons of mass destruction, in the evening, leave in the morning without killing a single Iraqi. That's my plan.
And his reply?
For a week or so, the president really everywhere spoke and quoted me that I am for intervention and so forth. And then the intervention he had. You know, presidents are like that. At the best, they listen to you one day. In this case, he listened the whole week. But afterwards, other people came and gave different, you know, who. And they all came and gave different advice. It became a war.
We're talking with Elie Wiesel, Nobel Peace Prize winner, author of the new book, A Mad Desire to Dance. He, like others, got hit by all the problems with Bernard Madoff, who's very much in the news today. At a panel discussion in last month, assembled by Portfolio Magazine in New York, he talked about what the financier did, saying it went beyond a mere swindle, entered the realm of evil. Let's listen.
Once you enter evil, it's not static, it's dynamic. You go deeper into it. And in the beginning, it was a small thing. He tried to cheat a bank or something. And then it went further. At the end, he went on to swindle thousands and thousands of people and hurting thousands and thousands of people. Take our little foundation. We have, my wife takes care of 1,000 Ethiopian children in Israel. What he does to them. We were going to open a third center in Jerusalem. We cannot do it now. What they have done to others, to hospitals, to educational institutions, my God, didn't he think?
Elie Wiesel's foundation, his own pockets, lost deeply in the Madoff scandal. He was asked in that same discussion if he could forgive Bernard Madoff.
Could I ever forgive him? No. First of all, absolutely not. To forgive, first of all, would mean that he would come on his knees and to ask for forgiveness. He wouldn't do that.
He wouldn't do that. News, of course, out today that Bernard Madoff may plead guilty to charges against him as early as tomorrow. We'll ask Elie Wiesel about that and speak more about his lifetime of exploration of moral issues and his new book, A Mad Desire to Dance. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nobel Prize-winning activist, author, and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel about his lifetime in working for remembrance and his new novel, A Mad Desire to Dance. You can read an excerpt of the novel at our website, onpointradio.org. Of course, it came out in those weeks after the Madoff scandal tumbled out. Many people had lost a lot. Elie Wiesel's foundation lost $15 million. He personally lost a great deal. I want to ask you, Elie Wiesel, about how you look on this man today when the news is out that he may well plead guilty, may well spend the rest of his life in prison. Here's what you had to say last month as a suggestion for Bernard Madoff's punishment.
I would like him to be in a solitary cell with a screen. And on that screen for at least 5 years of his life, every day and every night, there should be pictures of his victims, one after the other, always saying, look what you have done to this old lady. Look what you have done to this child. Look what you have done.
Elie Wiesel, 5 years you said then, now it looks like it could be life. What do you make of that?
Well, he deserves the harshest punishment possible. But I want you to know, Tom, that when the only statement I ever made in the last 3 months was at that panel, because, as you can imagine, I was pursued by every television station, by every network. I said no. I didn't want to give statement. I didn't want to be part of this conversation, public conversation. I didn't want my name to be linked to his. I want my name to be linked to literature, to philosophy, to education, to historical studies, but human rights, but not to this man. And the only time really I had to give one statement, that was the only time. Why? Because this man is, I don't understand. I really don't. But then I don't understand evil. In my novels, I don't have the perpetrators as protagonists, really. It's only the victims. I am on the side of the victims everywhere, and I try, therefore, to understand them. And I cannot see, why did he do that? Why did he need so much money? And furthermore, no, to go really to poor people, as I said in that statement, how many widows who are penniless, how many orphans now are suffering. Why did he do that? And therefore he deserves the punishment, but questions remain. Did he have help? Who helped him? And then what did he do with so much money? He must have hidden some money somewhere. I hope the FBI will find it. So there we are.
Let me ask you only this then. When you look at this case, the Madoff case, do you see it as part of a broader moral problem in our society today, fixation with the wrong things? Is this just an eternal story in human nature, or is it something tied to our times?
In other words, can anyone become a Madoff? No. Again, I say only a Madoff is a Madoff. There were smaller ones, smaller Ponzi's and smaller Madoffs.
Mr. Ponzi himself was a pretty big one.
Exactly. At his time, he was great. Now he was surpassed, to his shame probably, to be surpassed by Madoff. No, I still believe in the choice. I believe that we all have that privilege and that capacity for choice. I can choose. Now, why he did it is beyond me. He could have, let's say, swindled 20 million and stayed with it. Who would have discovered him? But to go to 50 billion,
and now 65 billion, the latest numbers are saying. It's an unimaginable number.
Unimaginable. Maybe that's what he wanted, to have a place in history.
He's got it.
To be the greatest swindler in history. He got that place.
He got it. Oh, boy. A lot of pain. Miriam in Newmarket, Virginia. You're on the air with Elie Wiesel.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Wiesel.
The name is Wiesel.
Wiesel. Okay, I'm sorry. I have read all your books. I'm just finishing the fifth son here. And I always had a curiosity. I know many survivors, they felt the need after the war to go back to their birthplaces and just have that type of closure. Did you ever go back to where you were born to look at your home and see what was there?
To Romania.
Yes. When I was deported, it was Hungary. Now it's Romania again. I did go back. I went back 20 years after I left it, and I was all alone. Nobody knew I would come. And it was evening, and I went to my house, and it was so strange. The city hasn't changed, and therefore I didn't recognize it. Everything was in its place. The banks in the parks and the houses were standing, and the trees in the garden, everything except the Jews were gone. And at one point, I was afraid. And what if all that happened to me were a nightmare, and the door would open, the door off and to my house, and the young boy, 15-year-old boy, would come out and say to me, "Stranger, what are you doing in my house? What are you doing in my dream?" It was a very strange experience. At that time I remembered, and I wrote about it somewhere, I remember that when I had my bar mitzvah, I got a golden watch from my grandfather. Now, the night before our deportation, we all became so to speak, grave diggers. My father hid valuables. My mother hid candelabras. And I hid my golden watch. And I wondered, I knew about where I hid it. So it was night, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, all alone. And I went to the place under a certain tree, and I began digging and digging, and found it.
You actually found it?
Found it.
And no one came out of the house and said, "Hey, mister, what are you doing?"
No, they were all asleep. And I put it back.
In the earth?
In the earth. Still there.
Why?
I wanted something of me should remain there. Well, little did I know that later on, the president of Romania would insist to transforming my entire house into a museum. And he and I came to open it. So something did remain. But at that time, 20 years afterwards, I really felt I cannot just accept the idea that all of us disappeared from this house where I had my childhood. And therefore I left it there.
Was that your only return visit?
No, I went back a few, but no, the whole term I did alone. Then I had to go back with the presidents and official visits. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, what a story. Let's get a call from Eric in Northampton, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air with Elie Wiesel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering about how can you cheat an honest man? And if our culture hasn't been so inflated with unrealistic expectations of return on capital as opposed to honest work. And what do you think about that?
You mean in regard to Madoff?
Yeah, like if people hadn't had such unrealistic expectations of return on money that they never would have invested with him.
Look, the question really is not to me. I don't know anything about finance, but the question is to the geniuses. There were geniuses in the finance field. Spanish bank, I think, said billions of dollars. Connecticut, billions of dollars. These are people who knew something about money. I didn't. Well, I know how to study Talmud. I know how to teach philosophy and literature, but I don't know anything about finances. Through a friend, somehow we felt for the foundation and for myself, why not? It's honest. If so many, we checked that he diversified everything, and we found out that he bought treasury bills. So how can you doubt it? But those who should have known actually didn't. The SEC, the SEC has tremendous responsibility in all that. How come that they didn't find out the truth? And then we found out that there was a man, Markopoulos, from Massachusetts, who said three times he warned the SEC, and once they even investigated, and they didn't find anything. So if they didn't, how could we? As for the culture in general, you are right in a way. Of course, we live in the culture of money-making. When I came to America, believe me, I didn't know what... Until I realized, I remember in a magazine, when they wrote about a certain person, they wrote a person's name, then comma, his age, and then another comma, how much he makes a year. Which means what a person makes a year defined the personality, the humanity of that person. I couldn't believe it. But that's the culture.
Eric, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Ali in Boston. Ali, you're on the air with Elie Wiesel.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have been listening to your program for many years, and also before that to Connection mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. Leiden. I came mm-hmm. and became exposed to Mr. Wiesel through his talks on mm-hmm. BU and on the world of ideas, but I enjoyed and become very informative.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that I would like to express at this point is that a president like Ahmadinejad in Iran becomes the advocate of a crisis and sadness that's happening in Gaza. And the reason is that the other people, like Professor Wiesel, have been quiet about this. I sympathize with him for everything that he has gone through, namely losing his father, mother, sister, and being a survivor. But the fact is, 50 years has passed from that, and relevance of everything that Professor Wiesel says, namely forgiving and not forgetting, and also would like to apply this justice in today's world so something like this does not happen. I'm referring to Gaza because this is the latest thing that has happened. United Nations, Amnesty International, and many other organizations has condemned that. But we have not heard anything from Professor Rizal, a person that should be the leading voice for such issue. So people like Ahmadinejad, who's crushing the human rights and civil rights in Iran, does not become a leader of a voice against such real crisis. So I would like to summarize my question. How come you have been quiet? You that, you know, the basis of your thoughts has been justice and preventing such things happen. It's the fact that has happened. More than 1,000 people have been died, hundredfold more than Israeli people. That, you know, I respect every life.
Ali, we've got it. It's a good question. Ali Wiesel.
Yes, a very good question, and of course I accept it. Look, first of all, Ahmadinejad, he is unworthy of being quoted even. This man is the number one Holocaust denier in the world today. Number two, he openly, publicly, repeatedly said he wants a nuclear weapon in order to destroy Israel. So really, we shouldn't even mention that.
But
man.
Is he empowered, Ali asks, by
he is not.
A vacuum,
a silence
of moral indignation?
No, there was no vacuum. I can tell you one thing. Whenever something happens in Israel, what I do, rather than create a fury in the press, what I do, I call immediately the leaders in Israel. There isn't a day that I don't call and try to quiet the situation. And I do my best. But it doesn't have to be always public. But remember again, what the answers that I'm given were serious answers. When the prime minister says to me, tell me, what should we do to allow them to continue throwing rockets, because they continue throwing the rockets even during that war, the Gaza war. They continued, and they throw on civilian areas, on children, on defenseless children.
Is there a way for someone of your stature to raise the moral issue, though, around suffering on both sides without diminishing Israel's situation, position?
Well, the only thing to do then, of course, is to organize, which I tried about it. I was thinking about it, to organize a group to go to both places and see and organize something. But in war, everything goes so fast that you must wait until it's finished, and then you organize meetings. Look, the first time when we brought together Abbas and Holmert was because my foundation organized, we were the first in history to organize conferences of Nobel laureates, because we have a tremendous moral authority. And that is how it happened. And I was thinking of organizing again a group of Nobel laureates to go to the Middle East and start working very hard, finally, to bring it to an end, meaning no matter what, to bring the whole situation to an end, because it lasted too long. Mm-hmm. And I'm still thinking about it. It takes work, but believe me, I am concerned. I'm terribly pained. It hurts. And the problem is that when the one side continues to throw rockets, what could the other side do? Accept them?
But don't think too long. Cynthia is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would be curious to hear Professor Wiesel talk more about the concept of forgiveness. He pointed out that Bernie Madoff was not actually asking for forgiveness. And I wonder under what conditions do we forgive wrongdoers who are not asking for forgiveness?
Cynthia, thanks. Our time is short. Elie Wiesel?
Well, in general, look for Madoff already, I said. But I have been asked when I went to Germany, speaking there, the parliament and so forth. I went to my students then are so good in Germany. When they need me, I go there. But I want you to know, I'm asked occasionally, will you forgive the German people? And then my answer is, I don't believe in collective guilt. I don't believe that we can give collective innocence or collective guilt. No one. Killers of children are killers. Children of killers are children. And then I said, by the way, I said, in Parliament, when I addressed Parliament, the Reichstag, I think it was the first meeting they had in Berlin, and everybody you can imagine was there, the entire Parliament and the government and the diplomatic corpus and the President. I turned to the President. The President Rao, and I had known him from before as president. I said, look, Germany has done great things since 1945. First, it became a great democracy, a true democracy. Second, it created a good society, and what it has done for the Jewish people, for the survivors, and for Israel. We have done great things. One thing you have not done. You have never asked the Jewish people for forgiveness. Why don't you? You can imagine the silence in that hall. Mm. A week later, I don't know how it happened, a week later he picked himself up. He went to Jerusalem. He went to Parliament, and he officially asked the Jewish people for forgiveness. So you see, occasionally some words carry weight.
Well, we'll be listening from the Madoff front. Elie Wiesel's new book is A Mad Desire to Dance. Nobel Prize winner, professor at Boston University. Elie Wiesel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. All the best.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.